I'm Jerwin Gabriel Santiago.
And I'm Elizabeth Wayne.
And we've never been wrong, ever.
This week, Spring Breakers and Nowhere.
Will they make it to heaven or hell? We'll decide. Welcome to... Rapture.
LA is like. No.
To tell you this really quickly.
What?
I almost so confidently sat down to pee in your bathroom, and right before I started peeing, I hit the top toilet seat that was like the lid, and okay. I almost like peed all over your floor and my pants.
And worst out of that is my floor, of course.
Yeah, and I'm not cleaning all that up.
Well, and I also want you to know you left the door open, so I...
Oh my god. You almost witnessed me pee.
Well, I heard you for sure.
Yeah. And you decided to respectfully look away.
Of course.
Thank God. Well, welcome to Rapture Movie Club.
Yeah, we're excited about this one. We picked two movies you might not think go together.
I mean, I sure didn't think.
No, we were a little apprehensive.
Yeah, I was like honestly really afraid to show you Nowhere.
No, but it was so good.
I mean, it's probably like my favorite movie of the year.
Well, yeah, you've watched it, what, like five times now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've only seen it for like, what, 3 months now?
Yeah.
Okay, so we kind of blew our load, but we watched Spring Breakers.
Directed by Harmony Korine.
And Nowhere, directed by Greg Araki. Smash! Oh. just have to let him know. I actually scared you.
You scared me a little bit. I don't like loud noises.
No problem.
And as you know, my voice is very soft and supple and quiet. I'm
whispering for the rest of the thing to not scare me.
Yeah, I mean...
What? Okay, so since you're the expert on Nowhere, do you want to explain the plot?
Absolutely. It would be my greatest honor. I mean, Nowhere is a 1997 teen flick about a bunch of kooky characters in Los Angeles, and their day just gets progressively more madcap and more chaotic over the course of probably just 82 minutes.
It's a short movie.
It reaches insane heights, though. And then I remember at the end of the movie, you just went, whoa, it's over?
Yeah, you're like, okay.
I'm like, so that's a hard review, but it really gets in there quick.
Really quick. Yeah. And I do have to warn anyone that is watching this movie, there is a pretty graphic assault scene in it. Yeah. So just be aware of that. We skipped over it when we watched because you don't have to watch it.
Yeah, the metaphor is pretty on the nose. And we did skip over the nipple being bit off. there were some parts where I was like, you don't need to watch it to get what we want to talk about tonight.
Yeah, so if you're a little sensitive about anything, just be aware.
To anything. If you're sensitive to anything at all. And then would you like to explain Spring Breakers?
Of course. I mean... If you were on Tumblr in 2013, you're already keenly aware of this movie.
PhD expert.
Of course. It is about four girls that rob a diner to go on spring break in St. Petersburg, Florida. And chaos ensues from there. They meet James Franco in a riffraff kind of drag.
More quieter smash from me, unfortunately. Yeah, that is a little bit, it's a little bit treading into my type, which is of course just like Post Malone.
He was kind of Post Malone.
Be very careful. But I mean, like, a great way to encapsulate both of these movies is that this quote is from a Greg Araki interview. It starts out like any other day with the kids riding around in the convertible and eating breakfast, and then it gets more and more fucking crazy.
Yeah. In both of these movies, like, Nowhere takes place over one day, and Spring Breakers is what, like, maybe a week? It's, like, 5 days, maybe?
It's funny because, like, time begins to disintegrate as soon as they meet James Franco.
Yes. Yes.
In a really cool way.
Yeah.
And, like, Nowhere feels like a bunch of days in a row, too, but you're like, this happened 12 hours maximum.
Maximum. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, another thing that kind of relates to that is that both of these movies are kind of like described as drug trippy sort of things, like Wikipedia as well as a bunch of different reviews of Nowhere at the time describes it as 90210 on acid, and then Harmony Korine directly describes Spring Breakers as this pop poem, the idea of something that was more experiential, like a writer video game that was more manic and physical. So once we got into the edit room, as it started to develop, the movie had this real liquid narrative. The film was closer to a sort of drug trip, more hallucinatory, which had a peak, a transcendence, and then you just disappear for a while, and then suddenly you're back.
Mm-hmm. And Nowhere is part of a trilogy called Doom Generation, right?
It's called the Teenage Apocalypse series. The Doom Generation is the second one, yeah.
Okay. And I saw in a interview he did that Nowhere was kind of the culmination of that trilogy. I haven't seen them, but you have. And that, like, it's the peak of the craziness that he was kind of trying to do with that. Yeah. And having watched it standalone, you kind of like go into this movie and come out of it as like, what the fuck was that? You know, it's trippy. It's weird. It's uncanny, but in a really good way.
Yeah. There are like laugh out loud funny parts because obviously the dialogue is just insane and from the 90s. Yeah. Like there's like literally a character named like Handjob.
Yeah. Which you could only do in 1997 and it's not like cringy.
Yeah. If it was happening now on like HBO, I'd be like, you're trying too hard. But the fact that this movie was like 1997 at its core,
if it was like an Amazon Prime original,
mm-hmm, and Jacob Elordi was named Handjob, you'd be like, ugh, whatever.
Okay.
But another big thing that these two movies share is they kind of like play on the adultification of teenage idols and icons,
mm-hmm, like majorly
in a huge way. Like when I first watched Spring Breakers in 2012, 2013, whatever it was, I got it from a literal Blockbuster. Yeah. Being like, oh, mom, like Selena Gomez is in this movie. I love her on Wizards of Waverly Place.
Mm-hmm.
A little probably too old to be saying something like that. But I like brought it home and like immediately the entire beginning is just like boobs, ass, and Bacardi.
Yeah. And you're like, wait, is Selena Gomez going to show her boobs in this? Because I think Wizards of Waverly Place was either still airing or had like just ended.
Yes.
And I was like, she's still locked into her Disney contract.
You have to remember that this is 2013. So it's also like the exact year where Miley Cyrus was like, Miley, what's good? Yeah. So just remember that when the historical context of this movie.
Yeah, which is, I mean, important. I don't know who, if you're like in your mid to late 20s, like didn't know what Spring Breakers was about, because it was also A24's first movie, like first big movie.
Yeah, their marketing campaign was just absolutely nuts for it. Yeah. And it also, like, the rest of their movies after that, they were like, it has to be as big of a deal as Spring Breakers. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, thanks Spring Breakers for making every other like A24 movie that you love actually come alive.
Yeah. Thank you, Selena Gomez, as character named Faith.
Yeah. God, I could kill myself.
We'll get into it.
Yeah. But MJ Corey from the Substack Deconstructing the Kardashians, we're going to be referencing this article a lot. It's called From the Archives, My Spring Breakers Review from 2012. The movie is founded on a gimmick. Two of the four leads are teeny bop Disney stars, Vanessa Hudgens and Selena Gomez, acting in their first, quote, edgy film, a move that New York Magazine wrote off as exploitative. It is exploitative, but there seems to be thoughtful and provocative intent behind the choice. This is an exploitative movie about exploitation.
Yeah. I think, well, also in Nowhere, like, we'll get into that, but Nowhere also kind of plays on this idea of, like, turning these kind of iconic teenage sitcom childhood characters on its head. There's a lot of people in this movie that at the time were known for just doing, like, teeny bopper sitcom.
Yeah, like, two of the actresses are literal people in Beverly Hills 90210, Shannon Doherty and Kathleen Robertson. And then, like, everybody else, like, Rachel True, like, the main lead girl, is from, like, straight off the set of The Craft.
Yeah. And Ryan Phillippe's in it, Christina Applegate, who at the time had just done Married with Children. She had not done Bad Moms or Bad Moms Christmas yet.
And that'll be a double feature certainly down the road.
And then also they had two characters from The Brady Bunch playing parents. They had the mom from the Vacation movies playing a parent in these, like, weird ass, like, it's kind of Requiem for a Dream kind of roles. Like, John Ritter was in it, who had, like, super big sitcom actor from the 80s, playing a suicidal televangelist. Suicide-inducing. Yeah. And it's really interesting because, obviously, like, when we watch this, like, we knew these actors from their career. But when we first watched Spring Breakers, like, we only knew them as Disney.
Yeah, I was like, Vanessa Hudgens might sing, and sure enough, she does. Right, right. Yeah. Plenty of times. Yeah. But I was, like, not expecting her to be, like, sucking on a rocket pop like that.
Yeah, like, or, like, making James Franco, like, suck the dick of a gun, yeah, you know?
Yeah, or, like, riding him in a pool.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That, and, like, and Ashley Benson, too, like.
Yeah, I mean, Pretty Little Liars is kind of, like, edgier, quote unquote, but I think that hilarious. Just because they wore, like, all black clothing.
ABC, you know? Family, a famous institution for edgy shit. Girl is pregnant in My Life is a whatever.
In Secret Life. Yeah. Put respect on Shailene Woodley's name.
I mean, I think I'll wait, but I'll wait for her to impress me to do such a thing.
But there's this quote from one of the articles we read that says, in some ways, this makes the movie a time capsule that any of these stars would ever be in this position in these configurations, and also listening to Skrillex is now impossible to consider. But viewed 10 years later on, our understanding of every artist's career arc only adds to the movie's power, its feeling of a weekend that stretched on too long.
Yeah, that's why I think, like, especially with the 10-year anniversary just passing of Spring Breakers, it's, like, only garnered, like, more and more, like, legacy and thought, because at the time this movie was, like, really panned and just kind of like, this is an incoherent mess. And then when you look at the reviews 10 years after, like, reflecting on it, it's a lot of people coming back to be like, actually there's, like, a lot of, like, serious reflection about, like, the American dream, the coming of age genre, that's just told in this, like, yeah, more twisted and non-linear way. But I think that that was exactly the director's goal. Mm-hmm.
And I think Nowhere, too, like, it was lost for a long time. Like, people, I read an article with Greg Araki where he's like, people couldn't really view this movie in the way that he wanted to until, like, 2 years ago. Yeah, because it was lost. Yeah. Exactly. And both of them have become a cult classic in their own ways, I think, because it is a time capsule of these actors playing certain type of characters, certain type of, like, feeding into certain type of stereotypes, trying to turn it on their head, which at the time maybe didn't come across in the way that they wanted it to, but upon reflection, really did the thing that they were trying to do.
Yeah, they really accomplished the goal that people were standing too close to see. They're like, oh, great. A Disney star wants to go crazy or, like, wants to break out of the child shell. But then it's like, that should be more of, like, calling our society into question of, like, whoa, this, like, does happen to, like, young girls.
Right. Like, why do they feel the need, like, no hate, but, like, why do they feel the need to take on roles like this to, like, break out of a certain kind of, like, box they'd been cast in, you know,
like being children who are, like, child actors being the most like exploited like group of actors.
No, like literally, and to just being exploited in a different way, which sounds kind of like hateful a little bit, but it's not. It's just, I understand like why they may have wanted to like take this route, you know?
Especially with like a director like Harmony Korine, where you can be like, I kind of feel taken care of in an artistic way, because it's like they're also venturing into like a more art housey sort of space. And I feel like with Greg Araki too, he's like a pioneer of queer cinema, and like anybody being attached, it was like at that time like looking for a job. Like Ryan Phillippe like books a whole ton of movies after this, not necessarily because of this movie, but Greg Araki was able to like bring up all of this talent, and specifically like elevating like queer stories. Certainly did a lot to like break down barriers for people like in the industry at the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, this movie like was nowhere wasn't mainstream in any way at the time, but it really did push the boundaries of like even art house cinema, I feel like, because art house cinema or indie film, it's like it's still like pretty binary in the stories that are told. So even like telling queer stories in the 90s was like groundbreaking in its own way, even though it was already classified as this like small independent movie, yeah. You know, even in that genre.
Yeah, and especially with like the storylines that he chooses, like the polyamory storylines, or like the addiction scenes, like he also doesn't treat these people like they're like mad spectacles. It's like he like normalizes this, like treats this way of existing with other people as like this is a baseline experience, and then gets to talk about like complicated things like, oh, my boyfriend is gonna jump off of a sign and he's like all strung out, and there's like a lot of like love between those characters. It's not like just like a sad like black and white sort of movie. It's like there's like a lot of like tension and conflict, and like queer relationships is just kind of like the basis of the movie.
Yeah, it's very, it shows like the fluidity of love in a real way. And like I found the relationship between Dark and Rachel True's character, like his girlfriend that's also like dating this other girl, I found it very like sweet, you know, because he just like, and that, and Greg Araki like did this specifically, like made Dark's character this kind of version of masculinity that you really didn't see at the time, like very sweet and open and like caring. Yeah. And I thought that really translated with his relationships with everyone in the movie. Yeah. Like he's a sweet character that is just kind of around chaos.
Yeah, he's like lost in the sauce for real. He's just like, he lives in Los Angeles and all this crazy shit is happening and springing up all around him, like the Hollywood machine, and also just like, I don't know, yeah, just like the like anxieties of the 90s are like weighing on him in this severe way, and he just wants like a sweet intimate moment with like one person. Like I think many times in the movie he like takes Rachel True's character aside and is like, I wish it could just be us two forever in this room. And I'm like, that's like such like a vulnerable and sweet thing, when like everything else, this movie is very punk, but it's also very punk in its way of depicting the protagonist.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I can't really remember in any media I've seen from that time really a male character portrayed in that way, written like that.
Yeah, and we were talking about this earlier like privately, but like the slacker genre where it's like, oh, someone's detached like from their reality and they just want to like disengage from life. But I feel like Dark's character is like, I really just want to be held. Yeah. Or like, and that's like a really like subversive sort of like mode of being in, yeah, the
90s. But like very human.
Yeah, yeah. Even though like sometimes he's like a caricature of like the dark moody film bro, he's also like, he hits like really human layers in this otherwise like cartoonish movie. Like on the flip side with Spring Breakers, they're kind of these like avatar sort of things. They like have this view of the world that's like full hedonistic, just like, I'll take what I want because I want it. Yeah. But then even under that like facade too, you get a lot of these sweet moments of like them doing girlhood things, right. Like cartwheels in the pool, or like pulling someone
like yeah. running in the hallway in their dorm.
Yeah, doing a handstand in a hallway. Yeah, it's so like, it's so Lana Del Rey. The last time I did a cartwheel was when I was, I get crucified by every gay guy ever. I mean, like, both of these movies have characters who are kind of stuck in places. Like, Nowhere is about 90s Los Angeles, and then Spring Breakers kind of, they don't really ever say where their college is, no. right? It's just kind of like blanket, this is a college, and you kind of get that in itself is kind of like, this could be anywhere.
It's almost like a community college, though. It's like a really small, it's not like a big state school. It's like kind of like in the middle of nowhere. Not even a college town. It kind of is just like they're there, you know?
And then they want to go to this town in Florida where Spring Break is because it's, but I mean, both of them are kind of like circling around this like American dream, obviously both set in America, but like they both have these ideals of wanting more than just where they are, which both of them are kind of like marked by like a time and placeness.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because in Nowhere, the characters are in Los Angeles, like there's people everywhere, like throughout the whole movie, but the characters themselves feel very isolated. But in Spring Breakers, they're in this nowhere kind of town at the beginning, but they are a very cohesive unit, very like bonded with each other, like these four girls, and then they go to a place with a bunch of people and then kind of get ripped apart as soon as they're around others.
They like become part of that huge mass that then gets like broken up by the cops. I definitely think that like specifically looking at the way that the art direction went, like in terms of like sets and like clothing, or I guess in like Spring Breakers, like lack of clothing. They tackle it through realism and artifice to reflect on this like American dream wanting more thing.
Definitely. They're both like very hedonistic in their own ways. I mean, Spring Break in itself is probably one of the most American things to exist. The way that it happens in America, like I know like people in other countries like do their thing, but the act of going to a beach to drink your fucking face off and take drugs and be sweaty and gross and debaucherous, it's like so distinctly
American. I mean, yeah, with like Girls Gone Wild and like all of that MTV, like I even hesitate to use the word documentary. It's like they're these like very like volatile portraits.
It's also interesting like when Spring Break takes place. It's like a break from this time in your life where you're working towards becoming like a cog in the work machine, you know what I mean? When after you post grad and stuff, it's like you get to take this break to be absolutely debaucherous in a way that you cannot once you start working.
There was some quote too about like them being in the lecture hall, and like he's literally talking about like the Reconstruction era of the United States, and like Vanessa Hudgens is drawing like a huge dick in her notebook being like, can't wait to go suck some cock at Spring Break.
Like, and it's so, I don't know,
it's, I mean, like it's hilarious, but it's also like the, we've only as like this generation been like promised things that have never come true, you know, like all of the like promises of like college to get you somewhere, we're still like, the job market is so shitty now, that all you really have is those like hedonistic pleasures and like
breaks from reality, kind of.
Yeah, like the nihilism you have actually turns to violence because like your boredom is like so insatiated, and like there's no proof of a future, so why not go to Spring Break that lasts forever?
And that drives the characters in both of these movies. Like, I think all the characters are incredibly bored, which leads them to this like crazy shit. It just gets crazier and crazier and crazier to try to like feel something in this life that they're unhappy with.
Yeah, and I think like the imagery provided by the sets like really speak to that. Like, in Nowhere, it's like almost like a parody of Los Angeles and how like hyper artificial and manufactured it is. Like, all of the rooms are like these like huge portraits that kind of reflect the character's inner world. In an interview with Wussy magazine, Gregoraki says that the core definition of German expressionism, a huge like inspiration for this movie, is the character's interior states becoming exterior. And that's how we approach the set decoration. So like when Dark comes out of the shower for the very first time, he goes like into his bedroom and it's like a picture of a guy with a gun to his head, like yeah, painted all the way across his walls.
And like the windows in it, the sets in this movie like actually feel like you're on a stage, you know, like the windows don't lead to the outside. It's like just kind of like colors or like a blur of something that looks like the moon,
yeah,
but isn't.
It's and like Pee-wee's Playhouse.
No, like actually. And when we like first started the movie, I was like, is it supposed to be like that, or is that like, it like took me a minute.
You have to like adjust your eyes to be like, am I supposed to believe that this is a house? Mm-hmm. Because it's so clearly not, which like builds the ethos of the movie about being like how the characters' lives feel like pretty unreal.
Yeah, definitely. Which is a interesting juxtaposition to Spring Breakers, which is filmed in a hyper realistic, like handheld cameras on the ground. Like you feel like you're in this disgusting frat house. You feel like you're on the beach with like a bunch of kids drinking Natty Light. You know, like you feel like it's hot and sweaty and everyone kind of smells bad. And but both like get the point across in a really interesting way, even though they are filmed completely differently.
Yeah, there's this quote from that MJ Corey writer again that says, the fascination of how sexual body parts can come into close focus for so long that sex stops being sexy, how the vibe of partying is rendered so true to life that the entire film starts to seem like one long discombobulated hangover memory. But this onus to desensitize viewers and the film's odd realism both point to a larger purpose, to deliver a jarring, sweeping, disjointed, but vivid layout of America itself.
Yeah.
So like in the way that Spring Breakers does it with realism, I feel like Nowhere also tackles it by being so manufactured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she had another quote about how you see so many boobs and so much flesh and like, you know, girls taking their tops off, that it becomes like sexless after a while.
Yeah.
Even though it's so in your face, over the top, yeah, like crazy.
The images of a naked person should make me feel horny, but instead I am just completely flaccid.
Like numbed out, which is also what the characters in the movie feel, you know?
It's crazy because, yeah, they have this like nihilistic, like daily life, like really mundane. And then they hope that spring break will give them like a release or like a transformation. And then they get there and find out that you can have the same sort of like mundane nihilistic view of life even when you have all the stimulus.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that like what's really cool about both of these movies is that they hit those highs of like neon fried like cinematography lighting. But then they also get really like, they get really, really intimate with just like dull flesh tones. So like jumping between these like two entities of like really hyper saturated and like really dull and human are like the levels that these two movies just like kind of schizophrenically bounce between.
Yeah. And it kind of follows the characters' emotional arcs where they're like chasing these really high highs and then it drops like pretty suddenly to like these lows when they can't get what they're ultimately like striving so hard to try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that like it's kind of like watching this like dance where it's like they're switching between absurdism and reality in this like really trippy way. And both movies act as a great foil to each other, because they keep dancing around that like American dream. And like, though nowhere does feel like a sketch comedy, sort of like really poking fun at things. I think it does have this like really like sweet heart to it that Spring Breakers also has, even though they're so in your face sometimes.
Yeah, it you kind of have to, I think in Spring Breakers a little more, you kind of have to pay attention to find that heart a little bit, just because it's so like oomph, all the time, like really fast moving, where nowhere the care, like it has more dialogue, so like obviously it's a little easier to pick that up, but there's a heart to Spring Breakers.
That portrait of like girlhood friendship is like really, really sweet.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, like the scarce dialogue that they do have when they're not like acting hard or whatever, comes like in like really intimate settings, like the pool or kind of just the pool now that I'm thinking about
it. The pool, like that parking lot. Yeah, where they sing like Britney Spears, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, speaking of music, these two movies also kind of encapsulate these genres of music. I identified Gregoraki as, like, a huge shoegaze fan in that same interview that we read from earlier. But the 90s and Nowhere are characterized by that kind of, like, shoegaze from the late 80s. That moody interiority of a protagonist who disengages from the chaotic outer world, while Spring Breakers operates on this sort of like pop of Britney Spears that's available in like the late 90s, early 2000s. And they always reference video games as this kind of like lucidity between reality and like their deluded fantasies.
It kind of does feel like a GTA video game.
I think that last scene specifically was like meant to reference like the perspective of a video game like GTA. Yeah.
No, I Spring Breakers is definitely like super synthy.
Yeah. You know? Like Jack Antonoff could never though.
No, like not in that way. And like in a Skrillex way. And it opens with Skrillex, you know.
And sure enough, they use that song 50 billion times.
Dude, our mouths were, like, literally, like, agape in that opening scene. We're like, hell fucking yeah. Like, we're in it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It just opens immediately, guns a-blazing. Harmony Korine said in an interview with Slant that when he was, like, envisioning this movie, he, like, wanted it to be more of, like, a mood rather than, like, super dialogue heavy like story. He said it's kind of like a tone poem, hyper poetic, almost like a pop song, which I think translates a lot
because it's poetic in a stupid pop way. It's like when Carly Rae Jepsen is like, before you came into my life I was so sad, I miss you so bad. I'm like, what? Like, that is so stupid because grammatically it is just, it just doesn't make sense. But then there's like this heart to it that's like, yeah, before I even met you, I missed you. Mm-hmm. Like, it's those like stupid moments of a pop song. I mean, like, that makes it my favorite genre. Yeah. Is like finding the like poeticism in like the most like blingy, stupid, floofy, earworm song.
Well, that's kind of how like pop music is written, is where you like write the beat first. You know, sometimes, and then you like you write the lyrics to fit the beat. It's not the other way around.
Like, that's why I think that like the reason that Party for You is having such a huge moment is because, yeah, that same exact process happened there. You watched her find the words, even though they didn't grammatically make much sense, that like feels like that moment.
Yeah.
And like I think like the scarce dialogue through Spring Breakers, it all being like over the phone, like these like voicemails or like calls to their mother, another kind of like girlhood sort of trope. You like feel the essence of their characters through those little things of being like, oh yeah, it was such a transformative experience. And like that,
after they killed six people.
Yeah, they shot up like six like different drug lords. Yeah. So fierce.
I think like that kind of pop music thing about it the kind of emptiness of pop music like translates into these characters and how they're just like super lost but just yearning for more. And like we kind of talked about it earlier, but that these girls in Spring Breakers are moving as like a cohesive unit, and the characters in Nowhere are very isolated, is an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, like Nowhere is structured like an ensemble sort of like screwball comedy where there's all these little plots, really essential to the 90s, like as like a way of making a movie, was like having two characters and scenes that just kind of like wove into one movie somehow. But then, like you said, with Spring Breakers, like they are this unit of like three people or four people. And then, of course, they lose faith.
Yeah.
One of the funniest things to ever happen in a movie. I think that like one of the reviews I read was like, not since the protagonist of Showgirls being named Nomi have we gotten a name pun that hits as hard as losing faith in the middle of Spring Breakers.
And you might think that's an exaggeration, but Harmony Korine actually said in an interview, quote, "From the beginning, the characters were conceived and thought of as once one single entity, one being. Faith's character is the first to leave, and she's the morality. So once the morality is stripped, you're left with something wild and dangerous, and what happens in the film becomes the result of that." So yeah, they lose faith and then they go fucking crazy.
I also read this really interesting kind of read on Spring Breakers, if I can fucking find it. Just searching the word id on my computer. Of course they're... Oh. So on this 10-year reflection of Spring Breakers called Culture or Vulture, Spring Breakers 10 years later, by Adam Naiman, he describes the like unit of the girls as like a millennial poptimism, as rampaging id, an insatiable viciousness masquerading as fragile naivete. Even as Spears sings, "This song's my sorry," the vibe is defiantly unapologetic.
Mm-hmm. And yeah,
like the girls aren't sorry about anything in this movie.
Maybe the first two characters, like Selena Gomez and like the other girl, they're maybe a little sorry.
Well, yeah, because the other girl gets shot in the arm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even then she's like, I don't know if I should go.
Yeah.
And then, but then she does. But Selena Gomez or Vanessa Hudgens and Ashley Benson seem to feel no remorse.
Yeah. Wait, hold on. I feel like their names are like Candy and Clit. Like, why does that feel right to me?
I think Selena Gomez's character is named Candy.
No, her name is Faith.
No, wait, I keep getting her confused. Vanessa Hudgens' character.
You have to remember that Vanessa Hudgens was the one who said it's inevitable, and Selena Gomez is the one that said, I love you like a love song, baby.
But I think the characters in Nowhere want to be connected so bad and like are doing so in like small ways, but they, as the course of the movie goes on, they like keep getting ripped apart from each other in like more and more crazy ways.
Yeah, like that weird plot where an alien guy with a ray gun just like abducts all of these different people, like the main gay love interest to Dark gets like zapped at the game of kick the can.
Yeah.
And like Rachel True's character breaks up with both of her primary partners from the beginning of the movie to like fuck these like crazy twin guys that I'm pretty sure are named Surf and Turf.
The blondest people I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. And if you could believe it, those are not CGI twins. Those are identical real twins. Like,
Oh, I could tell. Yeah. And then it's kind of sad. It ends on like a bittersweet note because Dark's character like finally is with this guy that he's kind of had like this crush on the whole movie, and they're finally like about to kiss, and he's like, I like you, like do you like me? And then he explodes into a monstrous beetle kind of thing.
He literally just does the Kafka metamorphosis. And then that's kind of funny too, because like, it's kind of tongue in cheek. You're like, oh yes, the movie is finally over. Like, he gets what he wanted. And then it does that like absurdist twist that kind of references like horror as a genre just in 15 seconds instead of like the last 15 minutes being thrilling. It's just this kind of like, what the fuck? This whole movie was kind of a joke.
Well, yeah, it just ends on this like bizarre note.
Yeah, the beetle like literally runs off and is like, yeah, I'm good. It's like, literally. So it literally is what it feels like to like have like a nice hookup and then the guy be like, oh, actually, this is too much and you, I don't want to.
I'm gonna come out your window.
Yeah.
But it's sad because it's like, it feels like none of these characters got what they wanted, you know, like they were trying so hard and it all just kind of like falls through their fingers. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one guy's, his sister commits suicide, like the guy that's addicted to heroin, hand job, right?
Yeah, puts his head in the oven.
Yeah, like, you know, they kind of start the movie on kind of like a hopeful note, like, where's the day gonna take me?
Yeah.
Death.
Yeah.
You know?
And it like messes with those like conventions of like a drama or a sitcom on like network television where it's like, oh, pretty much by the end of the episode, maybe the characters will just be like at square one again and they'll have to like go through the same issues again. But it's like, actually what is real is that a lot of death and destruction happens. Like, one guy literally beats up the drug dealer with a Campbell's soup can, which once again, Greg Araki, kind of king of nailing the metaphor on the head, being like, this like ubiquitous like marketing thing is what
beating you with this like pop art icon thing.
And it's like, advertising will kill us all, almost to a point where you don't recognize what's blood and what's tomato soup.
Definitely.
It's like, it's like on the nose, but like at once funny and poignant.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why the casting works so well. It's because you are seeing these actors that you recognize from these sitcoms, so you're like, oh, it's gonna end on a happy note, and it doesn't.
Yeah, like the dramatic stakes aren't like, oh man, he didn't go to the prom with me. It's like, oh my gosh, like my sister blew up.
Yeah, my sister was called to KMS by like John Ritter as a televangelist.
Yeah. After getting fully sexually assaulted by like a Dawson's Creek like actor.
Yeah, Baywatch.
Oops.
Sorry.
Oops.
Distinction.
To kind of go further on like the isolation of the characters in Nowhere, I feel like that also extends to like James Franco's character in Spring Breakers.
Yeah, the James Franco of it all.
Like, tell me why you're supposed to hate this guy, because of course he's like a white guy screaming the N-word with this insane haircut.
Yeah.
And he's like trying to show off all of his guns, but while he's like doing that, it kind of feels like show and tell. Like, it's just like lost child who like
definitely has, he's like Peter Pan,
he's like benefited. Oh wow.
With guns.
Yeah, yes, no, literally. But you start like feeling for him. Like, I have a lot of like pity and sympathy for him, because especially when he starts playing that pretty song by Britney Spears and they're all doing that insane scene with the AK-47s, yeah, like Ring Around the Rosie style. But yeah, I felt so sad because he is so clearly like alone.
Very alone. Like, he's never around people besides another set of twins, of course. He's like by himself the whole time, and you can see when he connects with these girls that at first it's nefarious. Like, he's bailing them out of jail, like bringing them into his world for his own set of reasons, but that quickly, like, the power shift changes to where he becomes kind of emotionally attached to these girls, but the girls see what they can get out of him, and like, to them, a fun, thrilling time, like trying to break free of their reality. But to him, it's becoming very real.
Yeah, like, he legit falls in love with them after like he submits to sucking on the gun. I think like one of these reviewers said like, it's in that moment that he reveals that his entire life has been like a slow suicide.
Yeah.
And that at least that he can have company. Even like with Gucci Mane's character, he even calls him like his old best friend. Like, there's no way to call him my enemy. It's because he was my only friend.
And but Gucci Mane's character calls Alien his enemy, but Alien is unable to do so. And that was an interesting juxtaposition between Alien and I think Archie is Gucci Mane's character. Where it's like the girls, there's this quote from the MJ Corey article again, and she says, "The girls, irresponsible as they seem, have each other. Archie sits in the middle of a long white couch surrounded by family and friends. Alien is alone, delighted by a chance to save the girls so that they think they will be indebted to him." And even when he dies, he's alone on the dock. These girls that he felt such a connection to just leave him after he gets shot. But even when they kill Archie, he's with people. He's like surrounded by people at this party that he threw. These people came to his house. He's like with these girls, you know, like he's got a bunch of people around him, which is, he seems like a less sad character in that sense, even though he's living this kind of like lifestyle.
Yeah, and I think that's also like a cool thing that Spring Breakers touches on, where it's like these girls will come in for one weekend and like absolutely like rip up an entire community like with their spring breaking, like literally just like kills like 10 guys like it's GTA. Yeah. And then like James Franco's death is so like abrupt, and like they get like both bend down to give him a kiss, but that's just about all the send-off that he gets. Like, he won't be remembered. Like, I guarantee you no one's streaming his shit on SoundCloud after this. Like, yeah. He'll probably just go away, like, washed to the tide, like, all of the Natty Light cans at the beach.
Mm-hmm. But I could imagine Gucci Mane's character being, like, really mourned by the people that knew him.
Sure thing. Yeah, he had, like, family. There was, like, literally a kid sitting on his lap in the, like, that one scene on the couch. Yeah. So I guess with all this in mind, we kind of wanted to have this double feature that really reflects on excess, hedonism, hedonism around the American dream.
And like the lengths people will go to break from their mundane, nihilistic reality and the violence and chaos and destruction that ensues from that.
Oh my gosh, wait, do you know what that sound means?
What?
I think it's time for Heaven or Hell.
Sounds good.
Okay, Elizabeth, Heaven or Hell being named Handjob.
If that's on your birth certificate, hell.
Elizabeth Skrillex.
Heaven.
Oh my god.
What about Campbell's tomato soup?
I'm gonna be more of a chicken noodle guy, so. But you know what? With the grilled cheese, send it to heaven. What about Selena Gomez being named Faith and then them losing Faith?
Okay, I'm actually gonna give that heaven because that's funny as fuck.
Okay. Puns are in.
And what about Jerwin watching Spring Breakers with his mom in high school, thinking it was going to be like a fun Disney thing, and then the whole first act is full frontal nudity?
I'm going to actually give that heaven because I think it allowed me and my mom to become closer.
I agree with that.
What about your butthole falling out and now you have to get surgery?
Hell.
Really, for me, that would be straight up heaven. My butthole gives me way too many problems.
And what about Kafka?
I'm going to send Kafka to hell low-key just because the last time that I was in a Barnes & Noble, I got a Kafka like short story collection and farted and it turned into poo.
Like, I knew you were going to say something.
It literally turned into poo as I was in the aisle of Barnes & Noble. Anyway, so hell, but Kafka, love your work, obviously.
So if you want to follow along to our sources and read what we've been referencing, follow us on Instagram at RaptureThePod.
And don't forget to subscribe and rate us 5 stars on your favorite podcast app. We will be back in 2 weeks for another episode of Rapture.
Bye. Shotgun out to the Pokemon and skin in your car and drop your car.